I'm Beth Golay, and this is Marginalia. Taya Albrecht was the 2011 National Book Award finalist for her debut novel, The Tiger's Wife, and winner of numerous other awards, including the Dylan Thomas Prize and the Climate Fiction Prize. She was also named a National Book Foundation 5 Under 35 honoree. Her newest novel, Sunrise, touches three different timelines, 2024, 1902, and 2003. Three different timelines, but one location, the fictional town of Sunrise, Wyoming. Through the novel, we're introduced to three principal characters, one from each timeline, who seem to have nothing in common until their paths cross as the novel unfolds. I recently spoke with Taya Albrecht about the book and these characters, and here's our conversation. This novel is presented in five sections, all in the same vicinity, but, you know, the timelines of the sections jump around. What should our listeners know about Sunrise, about the place and these times? Can you give us a brief overview?
Absolutely. Well, as you say, Sunrise is set in the same place, but over three very different timelines. When we arrived to the novel, we're in 2024 with a young woman named Nina. She has just been in a plane crash, and as a result of it, she's ended up in a lake in the Wyoming mountains. She has no idea where she is. She is very ill-equipped to handle the situation of being plane wrecked, as it were. And as she navigates the wilderness, with which she's unfamiliar, and searches for her boyfriend, Ben, who was piloting the plane, she stumbles into the town of Sunrise, unbeknownst to her, but very much beknownst to the reader, I think, from the very beginning. I don't think it's a spoiler to say that. And in stumbling into the town, she has also stumbled into two additional lives. One is the life of Anton Vargas, who is an erstwhile gunslinger and dime novel hero from 1902, which is the second timeline. And the other life is the life of Colin Yard, Col, who is an amateur historian and a historical reenactor whose timeline is in 2003. And these three people are deeply bound to the fate of Sunrise and, without knowing it, deeply bound to each other's fates as well.
I have specific questions about each of these three characters in a moment, but I kind of want to ask about these times. Was there something specific about these points in time that captured your imagination? Why these timelines?
Well, 2024, I wanted to explore a survival narrative in which modern technology was available to the character, but could not be used by her. So I wanted to explore a consciousness that was accustomed to seeking a certain kind of help from her phone, from peers, and not being able to access it. She's alone, she's in the wilderness, even though her phone has a bit of battery left, there's no signal and there's no way for her to access, a lot of the information that she requires in order to stay alive. 2003, when I started writing the book, I thought, well, this is a fine place to set a narrative line. I was a young person in 2003 and it was not so very long ago. And then as I began to research it, I realized that it was actually, a period piece at this point because it was 23 years ago. And so I had to refamiliarize myself with the music. But one of the reasons that I wanted to explore that time period was because it felt like a time of tremendous shift in American history post 9/11, right at the beginning of the Iraq War, and in particular a time when American identity and American masculine identity was sort of reinventing itself and kind of setting the foundations for some of the trajectory that we see today. And 1902, that's still a very long time ago. That's still turn of the century, and in the Old West, it was, still a time of horses and carriages, but it was also a time of tremendous change. The days of what we consider to be the true Wild West, that sort of uncharted frontier, the heyday of the gunslingers, was over. And so I wanted Vargas to feel like a bit of a relic of his time, even in an old-timey setting.
Okay, so you mentioned we meet Nina first. She's in her 20s. She's on a cross-country road trip with her boyfriend and an air trip, I suppose, for part of that. We learn that she works as a nanny, but information around her situation is released in more of a slow burn throughout the entire novel. Talk to me about pacing that release of information?
One of the challenges of writing Nina was that she's alone. And usually when I write a character, I like to surround them with other characters, as most writers do, I suppose, and let them kind of come into themselves based on interactions and dialogue. But I didn't really have the benefit of that with Nina. She doesn't have anyone to talk to. And so a lot of her character emerges through internal monologue and through her memories of her time with the family that she nannies for and of her mother and of her boyfriend, Ben, whom she presumes to have died in the plane crash. In the moments when she's not trying to deal with her immediate survival situation, that she reflects on her past and she reflects on the situation she left behind and this life that she imagines she's supposed to be living, this life that she got thrown off course as a result of this plane crash from. And those are the moments when her past emerges.
I want to dive a little bit into Anton Vargas. You know, his timeline is set in 1902. And this is a homecoming of sorts for him when we meet him. Why is his return to Sunrise significant?
He's lived a very full life. He is in his 40s, which at the time is, you know, sort of late middle age. And he's returning home. And I don't think it's a spoiler to say that he's unwell. He helped found the town of Sunrise as a young man, as part of a group of gunslingers, we'll call them, who were known as the Grey Rock Four, and who were sort of involved in this skirmish that's become legendary and that has become the basis of his myth and sort of is the root of the life that he's lived. He's been a showman, he's been a range detective, he's gone all over the world, he's lived very richly and very fully as the embodiment of this persona that began in this town. But on his return, he's found himself very nostalgic and he's found himself sort of reluctantly regretful. He's not, I wouldn't say that he's embracing the regrets. And he's come to make good, in a way, with the people that he left behind, in particular, a man called Preacher, with whom his connection is not entirely clear at the beginning of the novel, but whom he's looking for when he arrives in town.
Okay, so finally we have Colin, or Call, and he is in the 2003 timeline, and he's preparing to stage an annual play commemorating the Grey Rock Four that you just mentioned. Why is he relevant to this history?
Call is a young man who was born and raised in this part of Wyoming, and he has been trying to leave it for a very long time. He went to college in Denver, and he's been brought home by his father's illness, and so he's also reluctantly there near Sunrise. He has promised himself that he's going to leave. He's going to take the first opportunity that comes. But, you know, some years have passed and that hasn't happened. And so he's kind of rooted himself in this reenactment and taken on the, I guess, obligation of upholding the myth of Anton Vargas, which he sees as crucial to the existence and the thriving of the town. It's something from the town's history that feels really integral to the way he sees himself. He sees it as, you know, having the potential to draw tourist dollars. And it's a mythology that I wouldn't say that Call is aware of how much he's bought into it. I would say even that he believes that he's above buying into such things as myths. But with the arrival of someone from out of town, a writer who sort of has a different take on this mythology, it starts to become clear to both Call and the reader that he's pretty territorial about this story.
So how did you write Sunrise? How did the story come to you? Did it begin with one section, or did you see the entire history before you wrote your first word?
This book for me started with the story of Anton Vargas. I wrote the first draft of it for the first time in 2015, maybe even started in 2014. So it's been with me for a really long time. I was reading a lot about the Old West then. I was reading a lot about the mythologies of nation and nationalism and how the Western sort of functioned as a kind of propagandistic text to draw people westward and to make people familiar with, you know, what the Western expanse of the United States looked like. And gunslingers in particular, these dime novel heroes like Buffalo Bill Cody and Wild Bill Hickok were of great interest to me. And I wanted to write about a character like that returning home in a different state of mind, and in particular, a different state of body, sort of worn down by the life of a gunslinger, but also worn down by life in general. And it didn't work for some reason. The first draft and the second draft didn't work either. And I put it aside and wrote my second novel, Inland, instead. And then more time went by and I wrote my third novel, The Morningside. But I kept thinking about this gunslinger and this story of his relationship to Preacher. And it wouldn't leave me for whatever reason. And in the meantime, I started a novella about what I thought would be a young woman who's shipwrecked on a desert island. And I started a story about a young man in Wyoming who's involved in a sort of sordid incident in a bar involving a dead animal. And one day, I guess, as sometimes serendipitously happens, it struck me that the reason that the Vargas novel hadn't worked was because it didn't have a reader on the page. It was a novel for a reader in this world, but it didn't have a reader in the world of the book. And the minute I had that realization, these three stories sort of all lit up the same color. I don't know how to, I don't know how to say it any other way, that they, it struck me that they were part of the same universe of story, that they were all set around the same area, and that they were all dealing with themes of myth and identity and culpability and legacy. And that was when the whole story sort of laid itself out start to finish. And that was how it started.
Did any of the timelines pose challenges to you as a writer?
Oh yeah, all of them. I mean, the biggest challenge of the novel, I think, was the structure. Because as you've said, there are five parts and the structure is kind of an accordion or nesting doll structure. So we start with Nina and we end with Nina, and then sandwiched between the two Nina sections are two Vargas sections and one Cole section. And I knew that leaving any given section was a risk of losing the reader. But I also knew that the way the novel had to open up and reveal its secrets required leaving each section at least one time and coming back to it on the other end. Structural challenges always require a leap of faith from the writer to the reader and from the reader to the writer as well. You know, the reader has to have faith the writer is going someplace, and the writer has to have faith that the reader is going to follow them, and that these storylines which are opened up can be closed for the reader will read on through to the end. So that was the novel's primary challenge.
You're listening to Marginalia. We're visiting with Taya Albrecht about her novel, Sunrise. How did you research the survival in Wyoming chapters? I mean, what a woman from Queens might face in this situation and how she would react after a plane crash.
I would say that a lot of those sections were born of my own anxiety about how badly I would do if I found myself in a similar situation. I've lived in Wyoming for a long time. I like the outdoors and I like spending time in it, but I wouldn't say that I'm an outdoors person. And when you live in Wyoming, you're really surrounded by outdoors people, you know, people who really, really know what they're doing. And one of the things that I did was subject myself to outdoor spaces and to various ghost towns, in particular the town of South Pass in Wyoming, and stand there and have this, receive the sensory input of the place and think about how I would misinterpret it if I didn't know, you know, what that tree was or what it meant that the clouds were moving in a particular direction or, you know, what the history of the place where I was standing might be. Even when I knew the answers to what one might do in a particular survival setting, I had to negate that knowledge and rob it from Nina and sort of place nothing but obstacles in her way. And then I also had to research how one might accidentally survive, you know, what had to accidentally go right for a person to make it out of the wilderness or close to getting out of the wilderness.
Was it my imagination or was there a lot of insomnia happening throughout the novel? I'm thinking of Nina, Violet, Cole, and even Frederick Kipley mentioned it in the found recorded interview.
Oh my goodness. I've never been asked this question. Yeah, I think there's probably a lot of insomnia in this novel. Certainly Nina doesn't get enough sleep when she's out in the wilderness, but then she also doesn't get, it turns out as the novel progresses, as we get to know her, that she's not somebody who sleeps a lot anyway because she deals with a lot of sleep anxiety. Yes, there's a ton of insomnia. I think that these are all characters who are isolated and feel alone, and the nighttime is probably when they feel they're most vulnerable. And with Vargas, there's a kind of nostalgia that he's also in a tremendous amount of pain. And so the night is when he's really forced to reckon with the past and the things he's done and the things he's wanted to do instead. And Cole, well, he's grappling with the guilt of this recent incident in the bar, and also with his anxiety about meeting with this writer who knows more about Sunrise than she should.
In flashbacks throughout her life, we learn that for a long time, Nina believes that her heartbeats are limited. Can you talk to me about that? Because I found it really interesting, and maybe this might be a time to tell us a little bit more about Nina's mother and their relationship.
Yes, well, Nina is from her mother is a Balkan immigrant, and Nina has grown up in Queens, but I think that her belief system and her way of looking at the world are very deeply rooted in her mother's upbringing and in the traditions and mythologies in which her mother was raised. And her mother has told her two things. One, that a person's longevity is based, quite strictly on how fast their heart beats. So people with a fast resting heart rate have very short lives, and people with, a nice, slow, calm resting heart rate have long lives, and there's very little you can do about that. And this is something that I think her mother said in a kind of offhand way when Nina was a child, and Nina has really taken it, well, to heart, I suppose. And she has developed over time, deep breathing techniques and calming techniques to try to artificially slow her heart rate down. And she believes that this is something she's doing to advance her longevity. It's something that will come in handy for her toward the end of the book in what I hope will be a surprising and satisfying way. It's something also that she's, been told by a medical doctor is not the case, but it's a, as is, this is a book that deals often with belief and the things that people have been raised to believe and have come to believe and cleave to despite outside knowledge. And so this is sort of a foundational belief for Nina. She can't let go of it. And so she has continued throughout her early adulthood to practice the mitigation of her heartbeat. And she is in many ways captive to her mother's way of thinking, even when she knows it's wrong.
I found myself thinking about the idea of how what we remember about history is what is preserved. Another character we mentioned in passing, Louise, she's working on a book about Anton Vargas, and she's working with Call to research Sunrise. And we learn that one of her challenges is to balance fact with imagination. As a fellow author, what do you make of Louise's dilemma of how she framed Vargas and the history at Sunrise?
Well, I mean, I think it's a pretty universal dilemma for authors who deal in any kind of history. And I think that there's always a personal code of ethics surrounding how much to fictionalize and how accurate to be. When someone is a real person, I personally err on the side of being as faithful as possible. However, lots of writers don't. And that restriction is also why I find myself writing fiction. I really like to make things up, and Louise does too. But at the same time, there are things in Vargas's past that she has discovered that she feels it's more important to be faithful to than the things that exist in Cole's version of the story. The elements of Vargas's life that Louise brings to Cole are, perhaps facts, but certainly things that he would prefer not to think about and would prefer not to include in the myth. And it's this place, they're in many ways they're both drawing on fiction. And it's in that schism between the way they see Vargas and the way they see what's actually important about his real life that their conflict exists.
Yeah, I was going to ask because, you know, you mentioned we discover that Cole is unwilling to change how the history of the town is presented, even after being faced with this discovered evidence that contradicts what he has believed all of these years. That's equally troubling, isn't it?
I think so. And, you know, at one point she tells him, you know, when you discover new information, it's the old stuff that's made up. It becomes made up, right? And Louise becomes tremendously frustrated with his, I guess, stubbornness about this. And I think it's something that she doesn't expect of him. And I think that Cole's own territoriality about this and stubbornness about it also surprises him. I think Cole would, how do I phrase this? I think if Cole was told in advance the way he would react to this new information, he would not have believed it of himself. And that's the great challenge of Cole.
You wrote in your acknowledgments that the love story in this book was born more than a decade ago. The rest was written in a time of monsters. Can you expand on that?
Yes. I think that we are in a particularly dark moment, not just in American history, but in human history. We are at a crossroads with AI and the oligarchies that uphold it and that have decided to place it at the center of civic life, at the center of, I would say, knowledge, humanity, entertainment, work. The systems tied to this decision affect everybody. Maybe not right now, but they will very soon. We're seeing a rise in fascism that, you know, mirrors a lot of what happened in the 1930s. Again, not just here, but the whole world over. Divisions abound on all strata of society and at the top echelons of life. I don't want to say the ruling, but yes, the ruling class just becomes more and more powerful and tightens its hold on the lives of, you know, regular people. And I think there is something monstrous looming. And I think everybody feels it. You know, I talk to my students all the time, and they have this despair about what life will look like in 5 years and 10 years and 15. There's no map. We're off the map, as it were. And it is a place and a time of monsters.
Before we started recording, I was trying to, you know, figure out the pronunciation of your name. And you mentioned ESL. English is not your first language. What is your first language?
My first language was, well, when I was a child, it was called Serbo-Croatian. What I speak now is called Serbian, but it's, you know, it's offshoot dialects can often sound a lot like Croatian and can sound like Bosnian. I'm a child of a mixed ethnic family from Yugoslavia, and I grew up speaking the language and dialects of that country. So I learned English when I was about 7 years old, when we left. And I came to this country when I was about 12, and I knew English pretty well by then.
I was going to ask you about writing in English. I mean, it is your first language now.
I would say that it's the language in which I think, but it's not always the language in which I dream. I have been surprised as I've gotten older to see the influence of Serbian on the way that I handle English in writing. The languages of the former Yugoslavia have a great facility and a great looseness with verb and adjective usage. They're very rich and they're very playful. And there's a kind of vernacular wittiness that you're expected to serve up in conversation where you know, everyone's always punning. There's a lot of wordplay. And it can get really elaborate really fast. And it's something that as a, you know, non-native English speaker, I avoided for a long time because it didn't display to what I perceived to be the correct people my formal knowledge of English. I think that when you're an immigrant, you really, really want to show that like you have formal knowledge of the language, you can use it properly in speech and in writing and thought. And as I've gotten older and managed to maintain my fluency in my native language, I think I've let its eccentricities into my English writing in a way that I'm really pleased with. So I think it makes my sentences a little odd sometimes, but I think it works, I hope.
Do you have a hope for what readers will take away from Sunrise?
I always want readers to feel a sense of elation when a story comes together at the end, and, you know, sort of the aha moment, but also a sense of elation at having seen the whole thing, you know, the whole picture. This is a book in which the reader knows more than the characters all the way up until the end. And that is a feeling that I think fiction evokes that real life cannot, right? There's the chaos of real life can become ordered in a particular way in fiction, and everything means something. Everything ties back to something. You know, there will be a reveal at the end. And these are all things that we crave from fiction. And fiction, whether it's in literature, or whether it's film or opera or any storytelling mechanism, is where we get them, right? It's because we can't source them from life. So I hope that the reader gets a sense of gets a little jolt of elation at seeing the story come together at the end.
Well, the book is Sunrise. Taya Albrecht, thank you so much for joining us today.
I really appreciate you.
And now, book critic Suzanne Perez looks at a new novel that explores war and its aftermath through a dog's eyes.
Today's review is one for the dog lovers. Etna by Paul Yoon tells the story of a bomb-sniffing military dog who survives a years-long conflict and then embarks on an odyssey in hopes of returning home. Our title character, the dog Etna, is also the narrator of this slim but powerful novel, and that unusual point of view offers an original and poignant look at the devastation of war. The novel begins in an unnamed country where a woman named Su Jin appears on a farm where Etna lives with his mother and siblings. Su Jin chooses the puppy and gives him his name, and he discovers during his ride away from the farm that the woman has the unique ability to communicate with dogs and read their thoughts. Before long, Etna and a canine colleague, Fuji, are training with soldiers to run, fight, and sniff out explosive devices. The dogs also learn to kill, and Etna witnesses countless deaths of people and animals, as the dog breathlessly narrates. We walked and ran and trekked and rode in trucks and jumped through open and broken windows, he says. And we climbed and ascended, and we lived almost every day with explosions and gunfire, and houses falling and buildings falling, and animals running, and everywhere fire and bodies on fire, and the earth breaking and breaking deeper. He comes out scarred and battle-worn, but then decides to navigate the desolate landscape on his own. In many ways, it's a dark and depressing story, but through his lovely prose, Yoon manages to infuse the novel with a persistent hope. During Etna's journey, the dog finds humans who love and care for him and who restore our faith in humanity. And we learn what it means to keep going and keep trusting despite the bleakest of circumstances. For Marginalia, I'm Suzanne Perez.
Marginalia was produced at KMUW Wichita and is part of the NPR network. Our editors and producers for this week's show are Haley Krausen and Luann Stevens. Torin Anderson composed our theme music. This is Marginalia. I'm Beth Goldlay.
The fatal shooting of a teenager at a protest in Seattle has gone unsolved for 6 years.
This is open in your face. How are there no answers?
Our investigation has uncovered new evidence and witnesses who say they've never talked to police.
Did police ever call you?
Not once.
Listen to We Keep Us Safe, a new true crime series on the Embedded podcast from NPR.